provide the structuring of HR. And the development and implementation of a variety of new programs to address emerging employment issues and issues of such as diversity, recruitment, retention, new ways of working, family imperatives, and leadership and supervisory factors. I think her work is paid off the state as evidenced by many awards for workplace activities that have resulted from her commitment. Cornell has been listed as a best employer for working mothers, prospective and adoptive parents, IT professionals, veterans, something close to my heart, workers over the age of 50, and women executives. I mentioned that prior to coming to Cornell, she was at Harvard for 13 years. She's a certified senior professional in human resources and a graduate of Sydney Elmira. Megan is the new vice president for budget and planning. She came on board in February of 2010. I believe it is the only time in the history of Cornell and Chapel Hill that Cornell basketball was rated higher than UNC Chapel Hill. And an alum of Duke, I was thrilled. She is a seasoned administrator with more than 25 years of experience in higher education, financial and resource management. And she has a pretty big role to play here as the Vice President for Budget and Planning. She served as the Senior Administrator for Managing Cornell's Resources in the Annual Budgeting Process, providing leadership and applying university resources to meet our institutional priorities and academic programming needs. And she serves as a key liaison with the Board of Trustees, all of whom that I've talked with have really admired Elmira's calm strategic vision as particularly in the crisis. And along with the President, Provost, and Senior Staff, she advises the Board on the full range of policy, strategy, and budgetary matters. As I mentioned, she came from the University of North Carolina as a Senior Associate Provost there. Prior to that, she was a senior budget and management analyst in the Powell County, Georgia Finance Department. She graduated with honors from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, getting not one but two master's degrees, and then went on to pursue and receive her PhD in education administration at SUNY Buffalo. She is a proud graduate of North Carolina Central University, one of the nation's historic black colleges. She graduated from there magna cum laude, and while a student, served in Washington, D.C. as the first African-American U.S. congressional intern on the congressional payroll, as well as the first from North Carolina. She's a member of the National Council of Negro Women and the National Association of College and University Business Officers. So, we have the set side, we have the budgetary production side here. I thought I would just start off with a question for each of them and then open it up for you all ask your questions. I'd like to start actually with you, Elmira. And if you could give us your characterization on the state of Cornell's finances as we are moving into the fiscal year of our.
That financial crisis in terms of the market, things that affected our endowment, our debt on returns. We also, the market is gradually returning to small business owners. There's a lot of hope that we will continue to receive good progress with regard to the market returns so our investment and our endowment payouts can change. But we still have a ways to go yet. We still have many things that are underwater. While we've seen improved conditions, we're not back where we need to be. May not be able to be that for the entire country and the economy. Relatively speaking, with other universities, we're in a good place where we have control over our finances and we have strategies that we're developing to respond to the changes in the economic conditions that will help us maintain and advance our goals and our priorities. We will end this year probably in a better position than we had projected. In fact, a much better position. I'm trying not to celebrate, but it's in a much better financial position than we thought we were going to be in, and that's because the unit responded to the crisis and the call to reduce expenditures across the campus, and our alumni responded as well in providing great gifts, cash gifts for us to help our students. So we're going to end in a much better position than we were. However, going into in this fiscal year, we still have a shortfall of this state budget that is just too high as far as our annual operating expenditures are currently. We are. What we did this year was we reduced budgets by about, for fiscal year 11 by about 4.5%. Most of those reductions, a lot of those reductions, came at the administrative center unit office of expense. So I will say that we ask your indulgence as well as your understanding that we provide services, understanding that most of the hit for a lot of these reductions came at the administrative central expense. So understanding that, I think this was really important going forward. Because part of our strategy was to protect the pretty good of the academic enterprise, and very unsure to share a whole lot more about that with you. But I did want you to know that we are still working towards reducing and balancing our ongoing budget. And so this year we'll take other actions. The ITO office or the Administrative and Efficiency Initiative have been identified to help us attain those savings without having to go out with campus-wide structural reductions. But it requires we reorganize the way we do things. Have to do this with less people, and so that's a lot of the transformation that we expect to occur that will tease out more of the savings that get us to a balanced shape. So we still have work to do on that. We're in a much better position than we were last year and the year before, but we're not fully recovered.
Thank you. It does feel at times that the staff has disproportionately shared in the burden of helping to balance our budget and close that gap. I wonder if you could characterize the nature of the impact on staff. I'm particularly concerned about staff morale. You know, I have polled various library folks throughout the year, and when I raised the question of worried about losing their job, it tends to be everybody's inspiration.
Well, that's true. The impact was on disproportionately on staff. We lost over 700 positions in the staff. Now, most of those were not layoffs. Most of those were, over 400 of those were retirements, and several hundred were attrition. So the impact wasn't because people lost their job. The reason I think that it was disproportionate on staff was two members of the company picked up all that work, and our continuing to pick up all that work. And so the disproportionate hit, and that will continue to feel that way until we are able to change the way we get work done. And that's the struggle that we will face in the next year as we move from planning the administrative changes to implementation of the administrative changes. And that's the challenge that we have next. So let me step back to go forward, if you don't mind, to try to make that a little clearer. The universities have a reality that we have. The president, the real president, I guess in the one in the United States, has made it very clear that universities have to reduce their cost structure. We can't continue to increase the cost of tuition at the rate we've been increasing it. People can't afford to come even to these blind admission universities because we're outpacing what people are making. And so when you look at what makes up the cost of tuition, the biggest cost in universities is payroll. And most of us say, well, yeah, that's faculty. But if you really look at the cost of payroll, that's actually not that, which is all of us. And so when we look at the cost structure, we have to accept how our responsibility for reducing our cost structure in a responsible manner. When I look at that, for better or worse, and you can criticize this, I think it's a fair criticism for all of us who are just doing our work, I made the decision that in a rural environment, which we are, laying off 800 people would throw Trumkins County into a tailspin. And so we made the decision, President and I and other leaders, to use alternative methods to reduce our workforce, the staff retirement incentive and attrition program. Those are essentially non-strategic ways of reducing the workforce. In other words, you let people choose to leave and you hold those jobs open while the university uses strategic methods to decide what they're going to stop doing. That puts the burden on all of you who are staying to hang on to old ways of getting work done while the university systematically says, well, how could we get that work done differently? And that's what we've been doing for a year. Facilities have looked at how they're doing things, and IT has looked at how they're doing things, and libraries looking at how they're doing things. That takes a lot of time in a very decentralized place where, quite candidly, we don't do a lot of stupid stuff. We do the things we do because we're very customer-oriented and we're very decentralized. And we got that way because we heard somebody say, gosh, we'd really like to have that done, and people got it done. And now we're trying to stand back and say, well, if we had fewer people, how else could we get that done? And that takes a surprising amount of time to figure out, come together, and say, if we didn't have that many people, how else could we get that done? And that work of coming together and asking about agreeing on getting things done and then figuring out what we can afford against the systems and processes took all of last year for teams to figure that out. And now it'll take another year or so to implement those plans. And in the meantime, all of you have been straddling between old ways of getting things done, but without those people, and waiting for those new ways of getting things put in. What I can say is that I don't see major downsizing occurring during the next couple of years. I do think we will change work and do things differently. But I don't see the cost structures of the university requiring us to continue to have fewer and fewer and fewer and fewer people. I do think we'll replace work with different work. That 750 to 800 fewer people that we did non-strategically, we'll now reshift those jobs using more strategic methods. I know that's kind of jargony, but did that help at all? Dropped down ebbs and flows, and it depends on a lot of that. That number ebbs and flows on research, and it's hard for me to tell. The remainder had been at about 10-6, and the remainder is in staff positions. And so, boy, I'm not that good at numbers. The union numbers dropped down to around 1,100, I would say. That number will probably stay right around that number, and the remainder is in professional and support staff positions, and that number will probably stay right around where it is. So I don't see that total support, staff support, professional staff support number. I don't see that coming back. I think we're going to probably hover right around 700 to 800 less than we've been. I think we need to keep that number down in order to be able to keep our payroll base down, in order to keep our total costs down. And if we're smart about how we get our work done, I think we can do that. But that means dropping some work and doing some of our work differently. We can't continue to ask people to work the way they did work. We have to drop out work, we have to do our work differently. Folks have to resume work at a reasonable and healthy pace. And part of that, by the way, are the administrative systems, information systems, but it's also people systems. Working together across boundaries that used to be walls, those walls need to come down. And that's what we've been focusing on.
So Myra, you were at UNC when they moved to their work there. How would you compare and contrast the experience for them?
At UNC, they were engaged in what I consider to be first phase identification of the opportunities to achieve administrative efficiency and change. So they went through just that phase where they identified what the administration, the possibilities, and the places where they could actually squeeze out resources by rejoining, re-engineering some business practices. So they were very engaged with a smaller, probably part of the community, a lot smaller part of the community. Here, they have been through three phases. After identifying the potential and the opportunities for change, they moved into a phase where they started planning around the details and getting benchmark information accurate to see what the impact of that change might be, or at least propose alternative solutions to achieve change. At Carolina, that was left to the vice president, vice chancellor, and provost to decide how to and what change to take place. So here, they have been on a more prescriptive and more direct route to drive the change, working with teams of people around specific initiatives. At Carolina, they didn't yet pass, like I said, pass just the identification. So the testing of whether or not representation would be something that the campus culture could absorb or do, they did here, but they didn't do, well, they started the process here, but they didn't get into any of that discussion in Carolina. So here, they have gone through working through some of the initiatives with the initiative sponsors, the managers, and a team of people. In phase two, and in the third phase they're in, is helping to try and identify ways to track the change and actually a little more prescriptive in terms of what they believe the university can do. Where that process is right now, where Cornell actually takes ownership of it, is that each of the vice presidents and initiative managers have to really evaluate what has happened, see how they can actually implement, and that's where the culture takes place, which is where we are now in terms of pushing it out into the community and trying to shift and pursue those changes. That's the university thing that the university has to own. In the Carolina experience, the ownership has to be more immediate, and I'm going to say as a result, Carolina is way behind where Cornell is in terms of. I left right after.
Thank you.
large as Cornell has done. So Cornell is a lot further along in the process. What we did was, as part of the budgeting process this year, we used the enabling factors and possibility of achieving savings and efficiencies to help inform the budget process and the budget reduction process. And hoping that as we go along, we'll continue to be able to do the understanding that each of the initiative owners will work with the university community to tease out those things and make adjustments as necessary. So it's primarily, they've been more involved and they did a lot of the background work that is associated with getting the benchmarks across the industry and trying to bring in best practices from other institutions to share with the Cornell community before they make a final decision about what changes we recommend to try and make.
Their
priorities on the table, where the priorities of the institution can be taken into consideration and put it in the back of what they should use the university support pool for. The adequacy of that pool based upon the appetite of the institution to move in one direction over another is something that leadership will have the discretion to make, and all of the congressmen, deans, and vice presidents make their case. And so they understand what the values are, and you communicate that information about what decisions were made back to the university community every year. Another one of the decision items I think will be very important is model redesign has to do with space. The committee, the task force recommended charging for space, determining what space costs are, how we charge for space, who should actually own that space, and cover the cost of that space. It's extremely important in this environment where we have a lot of buildings going up, and there's no, and the center has no source of funding, so somebody needs to, if you decide to build a building, the question is, okay, so now you've got money to raise money for the facility, who takes care of the ongoing cost? How do we fund that? So those will be discussions, part of the discussions around space, around recharge. The recharge group is another separate group that overlaps with this activity. Will determine what services should be self-funded, or make recommendations regarding what services should be self-funded, and about the rates, what should actually be in the recharge or cost recovery rate. There will be activities that may have a component that should be allocated, and another part of that activity may have a component that should be recovered from a charge or from a rate structure. So the budget model steering committee is designed to take the recommendations from the four subcommittees that are working through a variety of scenarios. What they're doing is they're getting best practice information from other Ivy institutions and other institutions around the country, and trying to see running scenarios with our existing data and environment to see whether or not they believe it's something that they could recommend that we're working for now. And when they push it to the steering committee, we push back and forth and tweak it to see whether or not we can get acceptance around it. So the process is designed to have university community as much as possible participate in the discussions around those major core topics. During the budget model task force design, they took out a lot of the principles that I think the university was satisfied with, so what we have to do is basically refine them and put it together and say, this is what it would look like with these set of principles and practices in place, and let leadership make a decision around it. So there's a lot more discussion on campus that takes place around the various components of the budget model. Being an allocated budget, cost construction is another one, and what goes into cost construction. And how student traffic actually moves across campus to the undergraduates. I should say, we talked about pooled undergraduate tuition. So how do we distribute that pooled undergraduate tuition across the institution to make sure that students have the opportunity to choose any class that they want to choose without disadvantaging them as a student or a department or actually offering the course. Those discussions we're having, we completed the discussion with first round discussion with the dean yesterday about the idea and the principle, which was, I was surprised to me at all, maybe the feedback they were
really surprised by this too.
Probably, I was really happy about that, because it says that our approach is the right one, and it's logical. We have little details to work out around the nuances of it, but we're heading in the right direction with the strategy, and that's what we want. It's something that is clear for the most part, and we'll definitely be transparent and show how things changes in activity will affect changes in allocations and distributions, because it's extremely sensitive to the fact that if strategically the institution wants to grow in one direction, that we have the resources available to fund that direction as far as the direction.
So these areas of funding are deepening into the operating budget. They have a huge impact on staff, because in the past, in a way, the university was country did. And they said, you know what, we're doing great here right now, and we all do. And so, you know what, if we don't do this, that's really how we're going to handle our operating budget.
it's okay. Because while he is, look at that endowment. Look, he comes in. And now, you know, guess what? That didn't work so well. And so now, what Elmira is explaining is a long-term strategy for embedding the cost of when you build a building. Oh my, like there's a cost forever that has to go in your operating budget. And when you have accessory instruction going back and forth, oh my, you actually have to think forever about how you're going to do these custodial exercises have a long-term attention to the staff. So going back to what Anne was saying, this will allow us to embed a size into the organization. No location for it, afford it. Embed the organization size and then move forward without having to do what we did over the last couple of years, which was horribly painful to all of us and also to our local economy. And so this is, although these are but it is really, really comforting to know going forward that each of these protocols in the budget model, and you can argue, you know, a particular designer, you know, whatever, but as each stream of this is pinned down, made transparent, and explained, going forward, you'll understand it, and it will have a long-term, I think, effect on all of us in the budget that will be very
reaching that strategic goal. Can you speak just a little bit about, especially from the HR side,
yeah,
what type of cultural support will be there?
Yeah, that's such
as we move forward.
That's such a great question. Thank you for asking it. So, you know, we had for a very long time banked on consistency in our workforce. I mean, really banked on it, actually. And we're very lucky to have a long-term workforce because we really worked on tradition. It was like, you know, if you hadn't worked here for a long time, you couldn't make heads or tails out of the place because nothing. Like, you know, it was like, why did you do that? I don't know, don't you? You know? And that isn't really going to work anymore for a whole lot of reasons. As we move forward with many of the recommendations coming out of IP and coming out of finance, and we move forward with new systems and design, and we have the turnover we are just going to have in our staff, we will normalize to a very different way of doing business, and we will have turnover in our workforce. We are going to have a much more diverse workforce and spans and layers, as much as people have resisted it, is actually a very sensible way of moving forward with a more diverse workforce. What do I mean by that? I spent a few days with some of my corporate partners. And so they don't call it spans and layers, by the way, there. They call it doing business. And so I was with the folks at Boeing and Raytheon, and I don't answer what they do. But how they get their work done, they're very flat. They have very few levels, and they invent a huge amount of decision-making in very well-paid jobs that are individual contributors. And they don't have layers looking over layers looking over layers. They hire people to do the job, and then they trust them to do those jobs. And they're very diverse workforce. And so we have lots of cultural change to make in this organization in order to be able to move forward with a generationally diverse, ethnically diverse, age-diverse workforce, where we say to people, here's your job, and we trust you to do it, and you can make decisions, and everybody doesn't have to, there doesn't need to be three layers looking at what you wrote and the decision that you made, and using systems and being able to trust the systems. So we have a lot to do to get there. HR has a lot to do to be able to have a different design job family system. We have a lot of training to do, even for our leadership training and student writing training, get people ready for that. And we're going to have a lot of turnover really fast because, you know, folks were getting really ready to retire, and then what happened? Like, the bottom fell out of the retirement, and people couldn't go. Well, most people, their retirements are getting better, and they're going to just all of a sudden go. So we've got a lot to do to get ourselves ready for that kind of a change, change generationally, a lot of diversity coming in.
Great question.
Just a little bit from our office, one of the things that we want to do is communicate policy changes so that people that are coming into positions are new. The policy changes are going to guide the decisions we want to steer them in a different way. We want to train around those policies. The changes and the transformation will take place in this process. Partner with HR to make sure that there's ongoing training and classes there for people to understand the changes that are taking place. But the thing I think that, to me, that's really important is building in some professional development and bringing in and instilling or at least trying to encourage passion around the work so people can actually want to bring new ideas and have places to bring new ideas into their environment where they can actually improve on the services or change the services within the unit in order to enrich the employees as well as bring that back to the unit. One of the things, since I was the newly field of block property overall, but one of the things that I think that's important is to have passion around the work and be excited about coming and doing it, but also having a supervisor that's willing to listen to a different idea and you can bring that to improvement. So that change in and of itself, being open to new ideas, best practices, professional and developing the employees around their own work so they can bring and perhaps be ready to move into supervisory or different types of positions in the organization, I think will also create a different culture and a different environment, empowering people, as Mary has suggested, to be able to make decisions around their work is very important in order for us to achieve the kind of transformation that we need to achieve. One of my concerns, one of my goals is to say that even though we have less people, the fact that we can do it differently, we can still provide same quality of service. And that, I know that's a challenge, it will be a challenge, but some of the motivation and commitment and honor that you bring to your job or people bring will help them do that if they believe that we're thinking about them, as Mary always does, thinking about staff and their development, but if we make sure that we keep that as part of our goals in our units, as part of our performance programs as well, it would be important to change.
Okay, it doesn't matter how long you've been here or what age you're in, all of them. I mean, it doesn't matter whether we've been here or what roles we're in. We can all take on new roles and we can all do them differently. I think HR's got a lot of work to do to change the designs we have. I think HR is front and center to making a lot of this work.
I think there are sort of three bowls that we have up in the air. One is the message that the worst of our financial crises may be coming to an end. Two, that we need to continue to be disciplined about new processes and ways of doing things and continue to move forward in the implementation. But then the third thing, equally critical, is we've got to get that check effect around what we do here. It's one of those incredibly challenging, exciting universities to work at. And that third element, you know, has to be tempered by those other two. But, it, you know, that's where I hope we can start getting more of our attention.
Many of you just, I went a long way to answering my question, I think. So I'm going to turn it into a comment. In your opening remarks, you said we'd like to never get back to where we used to be. And in terms of what you've been saying, Mary, and certainly in your opening remarks and since, we've kind of weathered the storm of the layoffs and the SRIs and the hirings and so forth. And now we're in a position where staff may feel overworked, either because of the quantity of the work or because they quantity of things that they've been asked to do a number of things. And the next step is to try to eliminate some of the work so people will be, you know, sort of comfortable again in the job so they won't feel overstressed. But, and I'm wondering at this point if there's not a change in morale, a slight change in morale. The fear has subsided of losing our jobs. Are people starting to look forward again and look towards getting ahead again and looking for things to get back, to be compensated for their job? Yesterday, somebody said to me, an hourly staff member said to me, said to a group of people actually, okay, you know, we all have our jobs now, but we didn't get any raise 2 years ago. We got 2% last year. We've got a couple more things now. I mean, there's kind of invoking this bottom line. So we're doing all this stuff, so what are we going to get paid? And I'm wondering, you know, I mean, there's a pragmatic response. Well, at least we still have jobs, or at least we got a 2% raise. And as the three of you have been talking now, is the response that, you know, that the next step will be to kind of even out the work a little bit and make it more exciting and present more opportunities. And my question was going to be, you know, what do we tell people like that from, you know, from your level? That, you know, things we may never get back to where we used to be. But you can, what can we say to them besides hang in there with your work?
Yeah, but that's, you know what, that's an excellent question. And I don't think things would be great if you have a job and a good answer. I think there's a couple of, and hang in there, unfortunately, it's sort of embedded in what I'm about to say. I do think that the solution is in crafting the job of the future. And so, by the way, embedded in kind of like, what do I get from all of this, is ambition. So when someone says that to you, there's embedded in what they just said is something great that you want to foster, right? If somebody has the wherewithal to say, like, so like, what am I getting for this? That's an employee you want to foster. But that's a good thing that somebody says, I'm working really hard. I got like nothing left the year before, and I love it. 2% increase in life. I keep doing this. I'm like excited to hear that. Because that's somebody who says, like, why should I keep doing this? I'm thrilled. Because at least they have a chance at it. And so I think what you want to, I think what we need to do is we need to complete the process which we haven't completed yet, which is finishing the design. And what's frustrating to people, and rightfully so, is it's taking a while. And so first you have to complete the design of the process, and then you complete the design of the job. When those jobs are designed, the people who are talented have an opportunity for a better job. And a good individual who's willing to work, i.e. has ambition, has an opportunity for a better job, and a better job is going to pay better. Now, what I can't tell you is whether that person is the right person for the better job. But if they are, that's where the better pay comes in. And what we have got to break, what we have got to break, is a concept that says everybody sits in the chairs, and there's a step, and it's, you know, perniciously okay, and everybody gets something slightly variant of that perniciously okay step. Because that's not going to get us, going forward, great performers. We need to think differently, I think, going ahead to real performance-based pay. And again, this is where I keep on telling myself. HR has to think about pay practices that allow you as leaders to really differentiate pay. Bonus programs, pay for performance programs that throughout the year that allow you to go to somebody who's really been, you know, knocking themselves out. It's not going to ever be a lot of money. We're non-profit for a reason. I'm going back to that real president, he's not going to stop saying to university president, look, folks are going broke sending their kids to college. So we're going to have to think about ways to keep those people motivated that aren't huge dollars. But we got to keep them motivated. How can we do that? You know, can we give them, it sounds like, as long as they're there, can we give them, you know, movie tickets? Send them to, you know, can we do things for you? You can decide if you're really managing, you're paying fair, you're really managing, people stay motivated. I've been at the university for a long time, and I spent a long time trying to go with people to support people feel keep them motivated. If they're paid fair and they're talked to and they're treated fairly and they're given responsibility and decision making over their work, they will respond. We've just been through a hellish period, and right now we have got to get people enthused, excited. We've got to listen to them. We've got to get their jobs to a manageable amount of work. That's our first job.
Okay, so let me respond to the same thing. We can never get back to where we used to be, or even want to, and in the sense that some that's responding to the economic environment and crisis is more global, and it's not just Cornell. It's a global, so we have global needs and global responsibility. But also, even within Cornell, we have, I'm going to say, individual tubs, units, and everybody's belonging. Kind of divided. What we want to do is grow the institution as one Cornell. So the thing around reimagining Cornell and growing strategically, addressing the priorities of the place that the institution wants to be in the future, says that we need to respond differently to requests for buildings or to requests to grow programs, but we need to grow strategically in light of the global needs of the world, because we're in the world community now, not just in the Ivy League, so to speak, or just in central New York. So changing that, going beyond where we were, not falling back, and I'm saying falling back to actually where we were, where we had an excessive amount of resources, and we could just do whatever we want to or expand in the idea. We still want to encourage and we still want to support those ideas and that creativity, but we also want to be strategic in doing it. And I think what's been missing is that kind of strategic layer that I think this administration and the deans are putting on top of the decisions that they make, which is a good thing because then we won't have resources to have or have not for that institution. We decide how we want to move forward, where we want to move forward. So I'm thinking it's not going to be just business as usual when the market does recover or when we balance the budget or we move forward more strategically as an institution. So that's kind of where I'm starting from in that regard.
Time for maybe one more question.
One of the things that a decentralized system has is it provides a lot of incentive on the edge, you know, around this, not from the center, but from the deans and the presidents and stuff to go out and build and to a lot of incentive there. Where as you centralize the model and as you have deans having to request, you know, funds to do certain things. I mean, how is there going to be a balance there? How do you protect the incentives to get out there and really do the best you can in a situation where...
I don't think the incentives are going away, and I don't think we're centralizing most of the institutions. What's happening is actually it's becoming more decentralized as well as actually being proposed. Most of the revenue is going to the deans. The deans, the fundraising strategy now is that it's pushed out to the deans in the areas, and they're actually raising funds for their area. We only have a small amount of resources that central administration would be able to try and move the university in strategic direction. So the actual model that we're developing actually is trying to get the central support streamlined so they can support the individual decisions that they're making. We have to do that with some resources. And we also have to say that the institution as a whole has to have a strategic direction that moves all these units up in global scale. And in order to do that, there has to be some resources simply in order to, for the provost and the president to be able to move strategically in the direction.
So, I mean, is that going to be more than the provost and the president have now?
Yeah, there is nothing now.
Nothing.
That's the problem. That's part of the simple problem. But, let me go a little bit further into some of the detail. The primary source that the Central University had comes from CAM charge and from some unrestricted gift and investment returns. But the need that comes to the Central for administrative support systems to help you do your work better, financial, HR, all of that has to come from someplace. There is no source of about an increase in the TAM charge, which is what we have to do among all the administrative units to try to provide the services that you would want. What we're trying to do in the new model design is to try and get a fair assessment of what it actually costs to run administrative services and be able to have an emergency community for all of the resources of Bowman to share in that. And I think the library representatives are that same way. As a primarily largely allocated budget, in order to get money to do the things that we need, we've got to tap into the resources that are coming to the distributed community because that's where money is going. And the development model is designed to push even more to the activity.
The reality is that if you are a payer of the bill, you owe the disability. And if you are a receiver of the money, you owe the community. It doesn't matter which design or what design you have, that's just the way it is. How many of you pay a tax and go, gosh, I think that tax is a little low? I don't know. So we're faced with this critical reality, right? If you're a taxpayer, I don't know about you, but I have never, ever had that experience as a taxpayer. God, I wish they paid that. Right? So we're faced with the reality, which is that we are a confederation of place that we are one single place for something and a whole bunch of different places for a lot of other things. And we like to work alone when it serves our purposes, and we like to work together when it serves our purposes, and we don't agree on the number. And so that's just, as long as I've been here and was at Ray and Harvard, that's just the way we are. Like this big multi-headed monster that bites the heads, bite each other, and then kill each other. Right? And that's how we are, and that's how it will be through this entire budget discussion, the most bizarre thing. And, we'll come to some very odd truth at some point, and then, that people will go, who thought this was coming up? And, then the pet will almost swing, and somebody will answer us, we'll go, after it again. That's just the way it is. But it takes a certain amount of money in the center to run it. It takes a certain amount of money in the community to run it. And we'll say, yeah, of course. So we're going to start calling you hybrids. Well, I want to thank both of you for having been spending this time with us. And so can you please...